you really see the superior range of Shatner, like being able to go through between serious and charming, emotional.
It is good. Sorry, I'm just adjusting.
Hey, Idol. Hey, is your bladder empty?
My bladder is now empty, and we can begin. Welcome to Star Trek Trek Trek, our ongoing review of the Star Trek episodes as we choose to watch them. This episode we have literally just watched and are now reviewing Where No Man Has Gone Before, for the second pilot, yet the third or fourth episode from the original series, and third episode to air, strangely enough. I'm going to start this. We're going to mix things up on these Star Trek Trek Treks. We've been doing things traditionally for quite some time. It's time to mix it up a little bit. I'm going to ask you all a question. Two of you already know what question I'm going to ask. Shai, you missed the briefing. But what other Trek cast could have pulled off this episode? And you cannot say The Next Generation, because that would be cheating, because they did do this episode technically. What other Trek cast could have pulled off Where No Man Has Gone Before? Who would like to go first?
Literally any of them, because this is like a seminal Star Trek plot. Like, guess what? I'll take the easy answer and say Lower Decks, because they did.
I think in every episode, every series of Star Trek, there has kind of been a version of this story.
Well, yeah, because Sisko gets god powers, Riker infamously gets god powers, Jack Ransom gets god powers, and they all deal with it in various different ways. Sisko is a god.
No, Kira and Jake also become, like, god powers, right?
See, Enterprise might be the only one that doesn't, because the closest they get is, like, the Organians, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Discovery doesn't really do it.
Discovery can get the bonus point for actually going back to the Galactic Barrier in Season 4.
Yeah.
So they did go there, okay, so that can kind of count on those lines as well. Yeah. TAS even had some sort of version of this story as well.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But yes, so this episode was directed by James Goldstone, who also directed What Are Little Girls Made Of, which will be featured later in the series.
That is a good episode.
That's the Roger Corby and the Ruck and the very awkward looking stone that the geode that Kirk produces. And in August of 1966, Gene Roddenberry actually offered Goldstone the job of line producer for Star Trek, but he declined, saying, "Gene, if I produced it, I'd have to watch it." So I think he was less than impressed with the genre, maybe. But this was also written by Samuel A. Peeples, who also wrote Beyond the Farthest Star, which we watched in a previous Trek Trek. Remember that? Just a little programming notes as well. After our Stranger Worlds reviews, we'll be then going back to a two-weekly schedule on these, so if you don't see one next week, that's why. Anyway, guys, what do we think of going back to Where No Man Has Gone Before? How did this hold up?
Well, I think Jenna deserves to ask answer the question here.
Go on.
Yeah, I mean, I was entertained. I really enjoyed it. Mm. It was deliciously campy, as TOS tends to be, and it wasn't super problematic. It was a seminal, like, science fiction story. Mm. You know, unknown strange energy transforms members of the crew, and they have to figure out how to deal with that while trying to hold on to the humanity of the people that are being transformed. So it's a standard trope, and I enjoyed it.
Well, I also meant the question about what other cast do you think could do this?
I think it would be cool to see Voyager do it, just because they were always they were so
Threshold,
far away from everything.
Does that count?
No, it does not count.
Turning into a salamander is not a power.
They turned into godlike beings? No, okay.
No.
Who would it be? Who would get the powers? Neelix?
Yeah, that's the question, actually. Yeah, so of the ones that didn't do it, so Voyager, Enterprise, Discovery, which one, who would you pick on the main cast to do it? Because I think actually Neelix would be an interesting one.
Saru. Yeah,
Tuvok and Neelix.
I see you. I see you looking at my woman, Paris.
Oh my god.
Just drowns him in spaghetti.
Tilly, would she be actually
Tilly
Trip.
Kes does become like kind of all powerful at one point.
Fury is kind of that.
Mayweather,
and even Cold Fire too, a little bit.
Yeah,
that's Mayweather.
Mayweather,
Suspiria. Mayweather.
Yeah,
we couldn't get.
Yeah, they could have done it They could have done it with like a caretaker bit, like where one of them imbues them with the power of the caretaker. It would have been very, very easy. I feel like on Discovery, Saru, I feel like the whole Kelpian race is on the verge of becoming uber powered because they learn and evolve so quickly after they realize they don't have to be called, that that whole race could have become like the big bad for one of the seasons if they wanted.
The Baul,
even the Stamets.
No.
Evil Kelpians.
So the big famous line is here. This is actually the second pilot, which was filmed a year or so after the Cage failed to be approved by NBC. And having a second pilot is hugely rare in any circumstance. But I believe people understood that. Oh, I think we can thank Lucille Ball for that opportunity from DeZulu Studios. You know, I love Lucille Ball. But the they gave it a second chance, and they ordered three scripts. The three scripts they chose were this one. It was also possibly going to be Mud's Women or The Omega Glory as introductions to the series. And I kind of think, yeah, I'm glad they
fuck
picked
me.
This. Well, they picked they picked those three, and then it started up with The Man Trap. So I think it's kind of it's a little bit mute. But Mud's Women would have been
The Man Trap.
Mud's Women. Oh, that would have been
welcome to our series. Terrible. We're all about this. This is Gene Roddenberry's vision.
They keep rejecting Omega Glory for a good goddamn reason, Damar. Oh my god.
Yeah, but I have to say, I actually thoroughly enjoyed this. This was really kind of a lot better than I thought it was. I actually kind of think I prefer this to that to the TNG one, where no one has gone before, and sort of similar.
Well, that's a different episode.
I think so. But I think I definitely think we get a good introduction to Kirk here. We kind of get a little bit facets to every part of Kirk here. We get the commander, we get the action hero, we get the philosophizer, we get his chess playing abilities with Spock.
You
as
mean
well.
The philosopher?
The whole part about, you know, the difference between man and God and how power corrupts absolutely, you know, is definitely one of the good speech moments.
No, it's a great intro. It's a shame they hadn't locked down the costumes and the sets by this pilot, because then they could have easily just run with this as the real like on air pilot. But alas. But I do love these transitional uniforms. The slouchy neck on the women's uniforms.
They look kind of comfy, honestly. Like I feel like they could like slum around in that. Like it's halfway to a snuggie, really. When you think about it.
Sure.
I don't. You see the zip lines on the shoulders as well. There's a little bit points where they're just like, right, we have all these Cage uniforms, we've got all this other stuff. We just need to get a pilot out. Let's just throw something on everyone, you know. Before they go into like the later episodes, and they think, right, here's our uniform style. And by the way, here's DeForest Kelly.
And he's like, hello, I was in a lot of westerns. It's like, yeah, I can tell.
You want an old country doctor?
This episode's great. Ooh. Yeah, this episode's great. Honestly, like I feel like this is almost. The archetype, like the Cage is like, you know, obviously you don't actually meet any aliens here, but in terms of like a mission statement of what Star Trek is about, which is examining humanity and without any allegory, I feel like you get really, really like, deep in there. You get like a good mission statement. It's very 60s pulp though. Like I feel like it's like you say, it's in that weird transitional era where this isn't quite Star Trek yet. Because I feel like I associate Star Trek with a bit more sort of. A bit more camp, a bit less cerebral at times, depending on which, you know, series and how far along you go. There are very few jokes in this episode. There is almost nothing is played. Yeah, reminds you of Forbidden Planet. Yeah, absolutely. It's way more in that kind of vein. Day the Earth Stood Still, that era of sci-fi more than I associate with traditional kind of Star Trek. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I kind of wish some of the cerebrality and a bit more somber tone and kind of rubbed off on some of the other episodes. Like, I would have preferred a few more episodes like this than, say, The Omega Glory. E Plebnista.
Thank God we didn't get that one first.
Yeah. Could have happened.
The series would have died on the vine.
Yeah.
None of us would be here.
So I think the... you know, the foil of using, there were a few little trappings of that traditional 60s sort of, like, you know, the Frosty Woman on the bridge and the Gary Mitchell's ever so slightly HR questionable quotes he had at the start of the episode. But then his I thought that his actor, whose name I have actually forgotten and didn't write down,
Gary Lockwood,
yes, yeah, was actually really good in this. Like, there's a reason he went far in various in various films and stuff like that. He portrayed the arrogant god very well, because he was already a smarmy, arrogant helmsman, friend of Kirk and things like that, and he kind of transitioned into, like, no, I'm still torch and still awesome, and it was very convincing.
Yeah, it's one of those instances where I think, here you go.
No, I just think he's extremely solid. You know, you see the precursor to him going on to be a movie star in 2001 in, like, the seminal sci-fi movie of the 20th century. And Sally Kellerman in her pre-MASH days also really strong here. Everyone just really comes correct. Sulu's very, you know, Asian guy doing math. Very nice in the boardroom. There's a lot of diversity in the backgrounds. I you know, there's some things of the legacy of the first pilot sets that I like some of the build-ins. And I mentioned this during the watch along. I really liked all the sort of throwaway lines, like, was it disrupting space warp or canceling? Yeah. Like,
neutralizing
space warp, the lithium cracker.
Yeah.
Just throwaway terms. I love that stuff. Him saying, like, online. Oh yeah, she was Nova.
Light days away.
Mm. Yeah. She was Nova, referring to, like,
oh yeah, that was a cool one. She's so Nova.
Encounter. There was some solid sci-fi writing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting things where I think with Lockwood especially, I feel like this is where it could have used a bit more of that Star Trek sort of, like, a bit of humor, because, like you say, we meet Gary Mitchell and he's already kind of an arrogant douchebag. I feel like he needed a bit more time to be a bit more human, a bit more likable. I feel like, you know what, if I was going to do another Kelvin movie, I would actually adapt this episode and just turn it into a full, like, 2-hour thing. And then you get a lot of time with Mitchell before he becomes human to really underscore the tragedy. Because as it is, you're on the bridge, like, yeah, he's acting professional, but then he's immediately grabbing the woman, like, the yeoman, rather. He's immediately just kind of being frosty toward Dana for no real reason. And it's like, I know that a lot of that is, like, a classic 60s misogyny, which is thankfully dialed back a fair bit. You don't have any, you know, green women dancing, you know, for the pleasure of men here. But, like, I still feel like if I were going to do a second pass at the script, I would throw in a few more humanizing moments for Mitchell before he turns. Because you get some of them after, but it's a case of, like, you really want to get more of a sense of what's been lost rather than what he is now. But I feel like that is kind of the constraint of, you know, it's like a 45, 50 minute episode. There's only so much you can do. And I feel like they did really well with the time constraints they had.
I feel like you kind of get a loss of what Mitchell was through Kirk, really, because Kirk is definitely adamant.
Yeah.
Up to the point, you know, the scenes with him in sick bay, and, like, you can see the loss of his friend in his eyes, you know, Kirk not quite admitting it. But in this, where I kind of say, you kind of get a little bit, you know, that good stuff from Shatner in his early prime. And just, like, you can feel like he's trying to search for a friend in this being that's changed so suddenly. Sorry, go on, Jez.
What I was going to say a minute ago before we change topics is that I think it would be cool to see an introduction to Gary Mitchell in Strange New Worlds, whether it be through through seeing him with Paul Wesley's Kirk, or if they end up doing, like, a soft reboot of TOS, like seeing him on the Enterprise before. Before we get to, you know, full TOS.
So I'd love it.
He'd be on the Farragut, right? Because doesn't Kellerman say that he's only on the ship because Kirk?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Asked for him specifically, or
maybe he says he wanted him for his first command. So it depends on whether or not Kirk actually takes command of the Farragut, because I don't believe it's stated that the Enterprise is his first command.
I don't remember what the lore is.
Yeah, it's up in the air what Kirk's sort of previous history is, and the Enterprise history as well. He might not even be the first, or he might not even be the true third captain. Who knows? But might have a
standby. Slide another one
in. Jellicoe in there somewhere.
Michael Burnham too.
I forget what I was going to say now. No, it's gone. Something about Mitchell. Enterprises. No, it's gone.
So it'd be interesting if the Mitchell that we see is, like, some sort of weird gender bent version from the Mitchell that is on.
Well, oh yeah, that's what I was going to say. Oh, no, I think it's I think Jenna Mitchell probably come down as like, oh, that's just my dorky little brother Gary. Don't mind him.
I want to throw away a line like that.
That'd be cool.
That would be hilarious. I would actually think that'd be like a little bit of fun thing because like he's been sitting on the bridge for like two seasons. Yeah.
Sam Kirk's just like that little dork I used to bully.
No one. Guess what? Sam Kirk never bullied anyone. Sam Kirk was the guy who got bullied. You take one look at their mustache, and you know that instantly.
By his dad.
Yeah, fucking George Kirk Senior. Yeah. So I also have to say, even though the costuming may not be quite there, the prop work and a lot of the effects work in this was actually really, really good. Like we were constantly just like throwing love on how cool the phaser rifle is, and I'm really sad that I didn't get any play in the actual TOS itself. But there's like the map painting shots were great. Obviously, we're going with the remastered effects, but even still, like the stuff that was obviously the 60s practical effects still held up pretty decently. And of course, we've got to talk about the tinfoil eyes. Like those are just so dangerous. But guess what? There's a reason why you go practical. Because I was thinking about this. And you said it, Idle, I think, that you were saying that the way that Mitchell was holding himself and the way he was looking, where he has to kind of look above them, that is the exact inverse of the problem you have nowadays where people are doing a lot of work on, say, the volume or through CG and green screen, where eye levels are always off, where people aren't looking into each other's eyes because, you know, you're talking to a CGI character, there's no one there. And this is the exact inverse of that, where it's like, I only have a certain eye level to work with, but I am physically here and present, so therefore you are reacting to me like a normal human would. And that part of it really helps sell the drama and the body language of it, because, you know, like, you really, you know, it's such a sharp contrast to the way everyone else is acting that you can't not immediately notice that Mitchell's acting weird.
Fun fact.
Now you talk.
There's a point where I fill for time. This was actually this episode sets the record for number of Enterprise crew members killed in the original series. Because there was a total
11,
of
yeah.
12, in fact. Mitchell, Dena, Kelso, and the nine people who Spock say died when crossing the barrier. Just completely offhand. Like, nine people have died. Like, okay, well, what about Mitchell? No, he's fine.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I remember marking on in Strange New World Season 1, where, like, when, like, six or seven people die during the first fight with the Gorn, and it's treated like this big thing, because, like, those are the first casualties you get, and it's like, here it's very offhand. Kirk already does not give a fuck about the people who have died under his command.
There is a moment in an episode, Future, I forget which one it is, where Kirk just, like, through accident, it's the menagerie. It's where Kirk beams people out into space because he thinks there's a planet there, despite he didn't actually check on the thing. And then he just turns around and goes, "Someone stole my ship," and runs off. Despite the fact
he's an expert chess player. He's an expert chess player. You don't mourn the pawns after they're off the board. They're gone. You focus on the pieces on the board.
True. What is the largest number of crewmen that died at any given time in any series?
God.
Like,
it's gotta be a DS9 episode.
Well, if you're talking about like regular crew, I know that, what is it, like 40 people die on board the Enterprise D in Best of Both Worlds, I think, or is it Q-Who?
When
they cut them out. Okay.
It's gotta be Borg stuff.
It should be Borg stuff. Yeah, because it's either when they pull the sorcerer out, because that's like 22, and I know when they hit the engineering section that, like, you know, Geordi says we lost a lot of good people, and Data says like 40 people are dead.
I mean, you can get real technical and say that, like, when CC's 8472 come and nuke an entire planet, that might be the record of lives lost.
Yeah, like that's on the hero ship, right?
Like actual casualties that we give a fuck about. Yeah, because DeMar points out during the Ultimate Computer, the M5 kills the entire crew of the Lexington, I think it is, and like half the crew of the other ships.
Like, that's like Charlie X. He destroys the ship that he came aboard, didn't he?
Yeah, but not hero ship.
Sorry.
Yeah, it would be Dominion War, right? Dominion War would be like the
Defiant maybe blowing up.
But everyone got off the Defiant, right?
Yeah, I think it's like maybe 10 people die, I think, yeah.
First contact?
Well, really, it's really Star Trek 2009 is the biggest kill. Like, all of Vulcan. Yeah. Like, 8 billion people on Vulcan and, like, 140 Klingon ships.
Vulcan is not a hero ship.
I know. I'm just saying, in terms of, like, total death count,
if you want to talk about total death count, it's actually Discovery Season 2, when they show the entire galaxy being wiped clean of sentient life.
Okay.
That'd be the one.
That works it. Yeah. Okay, yes. Let's go on to let's go into
you win, best... Stars. You win.
Yeah, well done.
No, I win!
You
nothing.
Win.
Death.
Choosing first on our next section, which is the best and worst moments of this episode, if you would please, Stars.
I win that?
You
oh
win.
My god.
Oh, look at the fancy effects. Really, that was Nitro subscription. Podcasts are going to love
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, yeah, that really plays well for radio. That plays better. Best and worst. Best. Ooh. Okay, it's got to be Kirk's, like, speech to Dana, where he's talking. It's a lot of, like, kind of what you would consider cliches and tropes, but... Mm. You get style, points it? Because it's the 60s, so it's before that kind of becomes rote. And Shatner is just selling the living fuck out of it. Like, especially this early in his career, that man like leaves no crumbs. He is just, like, shouting his heart out. He absolutely believes every word he's saying. And, you know, that's the kind of speech that I believe could convince a fledgling god to turn on, you know, a slightly older god who is a bit more amoral at this point. Worst moment? It's probably got to be, like, Mitchell kind of macking on the yeoman. I felt that was kind of creepy and unnecessary, and I know that that's, like, 60s artifact, and maybe it's kind of meant to point towards his character, because apart from that, this is a relatively women-positive episode. Like, no one calls Mitchell a... no one calls Dana a freezing unit apart from Mitchell, even though there may be slightly indication that maybe people would agree with it, although I don't... It's uncharitable, but... Yeah, I feel like for the most part, yeah, that bit was what really annoyed me, the only bit. But the rest of it, I was really quite compelled and I was enjoying a lot of it. So those would be my picks.
Hmm. Genos, since you're our guest this week.
Ooh, oh, sorry. I'm watching.
What are those picks?
Where are you getting these?
He's on these. He's them, hasn't he?
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with my worst moment. It's doing another one. Thanks for distracting me. All right, now I have to cover your face on my screen, so I'm not going to
get the
anymore.
Type out.
I'm going to pigeonhole, you know, kind of dovetail off of Stars' moment. My worst moment is kind of the conference room scene, and I kind of got the sense that the men sort of had the sense that Denner was kind of like acting hysterically. You know, the traditional like hysterical woman that didn't play too well with me. I had to pick something.
Hmm.
I thought overall pretty good.
Well, because it's explicitly like kind of a man versus... Because an entire table full of women, and she's literally on the other side of the table. And also, she's in the wrong, because like she's like, oh, wouldn't it be a good thing if he became a god? And then they're literally like, he's about to try to take over the ship. And it's like, not flattering.
And I think my best moment is just the... I have to say it's the climactic confrontation, the hand-to-hand fight, you know, basically how the episode gets resolved. It's super entertaining. It's campy. I, you know, you watch it, you're just enjoying it. You're just smiling. You're laughing. I enjoy it. I enjoy
the doctor role is incredible.
Climactic fight. Yeah.
So. Shy.
Yeah, I'll start with the worst moment just to piggyback on the rest of the saying. It's probably like, you know, female professionals tend to overcompensate.
Yeah, a little bit.
No, but it's okay. It's okay because the female member, no, I hate that word, the woman in the scene, she said it, so it's okay.
She said it, exactly. my favorite moment is probably right at the top when it's just a little chess game between Spock and Kirk. You're setting up the rapport between them, and it's Kirk's like mix between seriousness and sort of almost flirting with Spock and teasingly about like he's like, oh, you didn't expect that move, did you? Like, and Spock. He still has, you know, Nimoy still hasn't completely locked in on deadpan Spock yet. So, but it's okay because it's just like kind of a slight.
He's just having a kiss with his boyfriend. He's allowed, yeah.
Right. Yeah, but we also see that Vulcan arrogance, like smiling, sneering arrogance throughout the entire franchise of other Vulcans. Sort of
play a very irritating game of chess.
That's right. So that's my favorite moment, and it's really. You know, you're immediately see the difference between Shatner and Jeffrey Hunter.
Yeah, I almost wonder because, like, Pike and Spock don't really have that many scenes with each other in the cage, do they?
No, pretty much.
And I wonder if it was a case of they immediately realized, hey, Shatner and Nimoy have like a way better chemistry, or if it was a case that they were told, hey, Spock's cool, drill down more on that, and then they kind of got the new captain. I wonder which one came first.
Well, because he's not the first officer in
that's true, also. Yeah. You lose Una, it's true.
Did they explicitly say he's the first officer in this episode?
No, but it's kind of set up. Officer.
It's kind of implied, because he's the one who's like barking orders on the bridge and taking command.
There's a lot of things that haven't been established in canon at this point. You know, we don't know the rank structure and who serves what. We don't know, you know, it's all Earth-based this and Earth-based that. We don't know, like, and there's no Federation or Starfleet at this point.
How about you, Idol? What are your worst
and best? My worst. Worst is tricky. I mean,
Stars has discovered Zoom, everyone.
Yep. Captain Idol, worst moment is all these effects.
Yeah, my worst moment right now is Stars distracting everyone with this terrible effect. Well, actually, no, they're very good effects, to be fair. I don't know. Other than what you guys have said already, I feel like I can combine those are also my worst moments as well. But there's nothing particularly in this episode that makes me kind of go, ooh, they shouldn't have done that, or like that isn't a product of the time. You know, this is the 60s, there is a certain amount of like camp and, you know, the fighting scenes with complete other actors, but you don't notice because they're on you know, they're on such a small television, they're not supposed to say. So I'd kind of agree with everyone else's worst moments. Maybe my thing will be I don't like the remaster effects. I know that's divisive. I much prefer the original 60s effects because it's a product of the time. I feel like that's, I don't like it when they go too overboard with it. I liked what TNG did more with the remaster effects.
Okay, then. Boomer.
No, I agree, because you're glossing over the work of like those amazing practical artists back then. And yeah, it's just the Enterprise floating against a black screen or a starfield. But, you know, they worked hard to do that.
If they want to tart up the planet, you know, like they do. They tart up the planet a little bit, but have the same scenes. But it's like when it's doing, you get all these different panoramic shots, and the model looks cheap. Like, I know they put a lot of money into it, and it was like mid-2000s these came out.
Yeah, it was. Like 2005-ish,
you know,
I think.
The CG model isn't as good as it could be today. I think there's, you know, and I would feel like I would want them to do it to look more like the originals rather than kind of George Lucas it, like they kind of have.
Yeah. Like, you can go to see that ship in the Smithsonian now. Yeah. You can see the original shooting model for the Enterprise in the Smithsonian. So show it to us on the screen.
Like. Yeah, exactly.
Well, don't they usually give you the option to switch between them? Like, you can watch
one
remaster.
They do, but the version I have ripped, I only have the remaster on there. So, but yeah, we can. We are watching the remaster ones for various reasons. Anyway, moving swiftly on. My best moment, I give me more Spock lecturing Kirk on, you know, his absolute morals and what should be and what shouldn't be. He is telling Kirk the entire time, like, he is not a man anymore, Jim. You must do. And I love that scene where he's basically over his shoulder, just kind of like telling him how it is. This is how you should react. This is your options. Like, doing what Spock absolutely does is best on. And this, like you say, the genesis of the character didn't really come out of the cage much, but it definitely does here. We see a lot more of that. The shouty, authoritative Spock that's trying to show the moral, logical high ground with no feelings, which we know gets developed a little bit more later. But no, I really like Spock in this episode. It's not his episode,
I appreciate that we were 25 minutes in and he was already advocating for the killing of a crew member, but he was right, to be fair.
That's a Vulcan hello. That Vulcan hello, man. It's don't say hi to a Vulcan, because you're...
Yep.
Okay.
Logically end your life.
Logically end your life. Stars, please, what is our Trek rating for this episode?
Gentlemen, how many of Gary Mitchell's intergalactic STIs out of 10 would you like to give this episode?
Gary Mitchell's intergalactic STIs, brilliant. Yes, this week, Genos, please. How many of Gary Mitchell's intergalactic STIs do you give out of 10 for this episode?
Well, you know, I was highly entertained. It wasn't super problematic.
The best we can hope for it wasn't awkward.
Right, for you know, 1960s. You know, it really did set the tone for Star Trek going forward. You know, one of the first handful of episodes. I'm going to give it a solid 8, Gary Mitchell's intergalactic STIs out of 10.
That's a lot of STIs.
Stars.
I would have to be, I'm really just like, this is just a solid bit of like sci-fi writing. Like, even if like this was just Yeah, I, even if I had no attachment to Star Trek, I would watch this episode and be like, that was a really good take on the story. It was unique enough that I don't feel like it was constantly ripping off even every other thing, even though it's inevitable when you kind of reach, you know, this... This is a story that's been told for a million years, you know, like the idea of, like, a man overstepping his bounds is basically just Prometheus. But, like, it's still just done with enough of its own unique take on it that I just really enjoy it. So I'd probably give it 8.5 Intergalactic STIs out of 10.
Nice.
I really liked it.
I feel solid. Like this could have been, like, if Star Trek had never existed and this was actually part of, like, a...
anthology show.
An anthology, like a Twilight Zone, but for sci-fi shows, and you got like a different adventure and a different thing, like a kind of like one with, you know, I think this would sit very well in its own kind of like little universe. Like, you see who the characters are, you get the plot, you see who the captain is. It's yeah, self-contained. I'm going to jump over Shy since I'm now talking, and I'm also going to give this an 8.5 and say, like, yeah, that's really... I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I think it was great. We got to see, like, knowing what we know about Trek, we got to see a great show from Kirk. We got to see a great show from Spock. We got the moral dilemma. We saw how the ship works. This is a great... It should have been the proper pilot, but we got the man trap instead. But this is a great introduction to Star Trek. If I was ever to show someone said to me, what is 60 Star Trek like? Watch Where No Man's Gone Before. That's a brilliant one. Shy.
I'm giving it a 9.
Yeah.
I'm giving it a 9. Ooh. This is so solid. It's like, it almost creates this trope. I know this trope existed before in, like, you know, Midas and all those sort of previous, like, man gets power sort of stories, but it really sets the bar for this trope in the 21st century. And really, it's the greatest hits of Shatner all right up front in the third episode.
You get the
right?
M's.
You get flirty Shatner. You get cold, like, commander calculating Shatner. You get fighting Shatner. You get, oh, my old good drinking buddy Shatner. It's everything. And he goes through the whole gamut.
This is demo reel.
Completely is. It's like, if you were writing an episode, which they did, I'm assuming, to... show you the range of your new ship's captain. This is it. So, yeah, and Spock and Nimoy really zeroes in more on his character here, and just the initial chemistry between them is great.
Immediate,
You're like, oh, this is why this show worked.
Yeah, so, and in fact, you know what? I have to point out, like, when we were doing the watch along, you probably noticed that they were often just, like, just standing and, like, it wasn't like standing, we were all sitting, but watching the episode, just kind of, like, letting it play out and not talking for good bits of it, because it's compelling. That's usually a good sign of how much we're enjoying something. Yeah. If we're just, like, sitting back and letting the characters talk, it's like, guess what? That means that you, who are also watching along at home, we hope, should be paying attention, because this is good content. This is a good conversation or a good dilemma or a good scene, just... sometimes you just don't want to commentate over it.
The best episodes are the worst watch alongs.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a great villain, right? Because it's complex. He didn't. They say it at the end of the episode. Mitchell didn't ask for this to happen to him, but he just becomes that sample of human frailty, like absolute power corrupting him. But he's definitely top 10 Trek villains.
I would love it if they brought him back like a Kelvin thing. I think this would like really stand adaptation for that, because, you know, just, I don't know, who would be the modern day Gary Lockwood? Who would stand up and go,
gosh,
Ryan Reynolds.
No, you bring in another Chris. It's got to be like Chris Evans or Chris Pratt.
Chris Pine,
right?
I think Chris Evans could do the coldness of this if you gave him the chance. I bet you could.
Here's a good little segment we can work on as well in the future. Like, for the TOS episodes, or even TNG, actually, who would be a modern-day actor to replace that role? Like, what about Dana as well?
Oh, Dana. Margot Robbie. I love her in everything.
Just cast her in everything.
She'd never do it. She has
experience playing a psychologist. She played Harley Quinn.
True. A bit of different, though. What about Emma Stone? Emma Stone would be great, I think.
I can see that.
Sure.
January Jones.
Is she?
Get old Emma Frost.
Like she's...
she's Emma Frost, yeah. Yeah, I could see it, though.
I feel like January Jones has only been good in Mad Men, and I can't really remember like a film that I've seen with her where I'm like, oh yeah, you're as good as you were on Mad Men.
Yeah, Reverend Demar says,
"What's the word on Mad Men?"
Oh, that's the question, isn't it? Yeah, Rev Demar says, wasn't the rumor that Benedict Cumberbatch was going to play Mitchell? I remember seeing that rumor, and I was really excited for it, because I thought, he could do it. He could absolutely do it.
That would have made much more sense. Yeah, much better. Let's just pretend it was Mitchell all along.
Too bad we're never getting Star Trek 4.
Yeah, never. I don't believe that the Section 31 movie comes out before that comes out.
We don't even believe that's coming out. Okay, thank you Janos for joining us. Thank you Shai, thank you Stars. As I said before at the start, we will be a couple of weeks back on our 2-week rotation before the next episode. We'll be back 2 weeks with the Lorelei Signal, so join us then for that. And we will see you soon. Ta-ra.